we don't want to be a mass tourism destination. My airport is designed for no more than 1 million passengers a year. And it was designed at 1 million passengers a year because that's the limit of the population that we want to bring to the destination. Because early on, we determined what our ecological ceiling was. And we don't believe that we could accommodate more than 1 million without starting to cause damage to the environment. We're self-limiting the amount of development that we will undertake to limit the population number of visitors that come to the destination, which from an aviation point of view is not what the aviation industry likes to see.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. Our mission is to show the many paths to net zero for an industry that is one of the hardest to decarbonize. So every week we speak with airline, airport, travel, and technology executives to help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you're a frequent flyer, an airline executive, if you care about sustainability, or just love traveling, welcome aboard. This is a show by Simplifying, who have been helping build trust and travel for over 15 years. This season of the podcast is brought to you by Cirium, which is empowering the global aviation industry to reach a more sustainable future with the most accurate aircraft emissions data. The show is also supported by CarbonClick, leaders in managing carbon offsetting programs for top global airlines. Without further ado, here is your host, Shashank Nigam, CEO of Simplifying.
John Pagano, the CEO of Red Sea Global, is my guest today. He is creating a new tourism destination that has its own ecological ceiling, that will be generating its own power using solar cells and the world's largest solar grid to power the resorts of Red Sea and Amala. John is spearheading a new model of development, putting people and planet first and leveraging the most innovative concepts to create this brand new tourism destination that will allow you to travel not just net zero, but true carbon positive. The interesting thing, John, is that in all of my podcast seasons, I've only had airline executives and airline CEOs and technology executives who are helping airlines. This is the first time I'm actually having someone who's not with an airline or does not work in aviation. And you're the first destination we have on the podcast. And there's a very special reason for it. It is hard for any destination to have great sustainability credentials. And you, John, at Red Sea Global, are creating one from scratch. That in itself is quite a curious thing. Can you please tell us firstly just a bit about yourself, John, and what exactly is net zero resort, and how does a regenerative tourism destination take shape?
Wow, that's a very loaded question. There's a lot of parts to that. So a bit about myself. You know that I'm from Toronto. I was born in Canada. I studied at the University of Toronto. I was an engineering graduate. I've worked in engineering consultancy for a period of time. And then at some point in my career, I moved into real estate development and, progressed and built from there. The question about a net zero destination, it starts with the story begins with the vision of the kingdom and His Royal Highness and, Vision 2030. And it's a very ambitious plan to transform the kingdom, to do a number of different things, including, creating a vibrant society, a more open society, opening up the country to the world, which is pretty cool, given the fact that it historically has been a very significant part of the world over history. I mean, going back millennia. So now for it to be opening up, I think is fantastic. One of those places in the world that I think people are going to want to come and experience because of that rich history and culture. But also, the pristine nature of our destination is really where it all begins. We are now the beneficiaries of lessons from the past. We know as humans what we've done wrong leading up to the current, climate and ecological crisis that the world is facing. And I guess when you start with something that's pristine, untouched, and maybe one of the last bastions of real healthy marine life, you know, it's an enormous responsibility. And we didn't want to just follow the traditional approach of coming in and really damaging what is here, because, as I said, this is could be one of the last places in the world that is thriving and alive. And so we need to make sure that we not only do we safeguard it, but we actually go beyond that. Given the platform that Vision 2030 provided for us, and I neglected to mention, obviously, you know, another part of Vision 2030 is to diversify the economy. You know, and tourism is a very important economic sector. It represents over 10% of global GDP. And in the kingdom, it was always underrepresented. It always was around 3.3, 3.4% of the economy, and largely driven by religious tourism. So on the leisure tourism front, there was very little of it. So, you know, combination of things, pristine environment, beautiful environment. We want to get into the tourism space, but we wanted to do things differently. And at the very beginning of our journey, you know, we set out to set new standards in sustainable development. And as you'll hear through the course of our conversation today, my thinking evolved from there. As I became much more aware of the challenges we were facing, it sort of evolved our thinking. So it starts, the story begins there. You know, how do I protect and preserve this beautiful, pristine environment? And that was almost a direction given by His Royal Highness. You know, you have to protect it for future generations to enjoy. Like, okay, that's a pretty big responsibility that you're placing on me. But we saw it as an opportunity to really embrace it and to really drive forward with it, and which is great. And I have an ownership structure. We're funded by the Public Investment Fund. We don't have the usual commercial constraints and drivers of short-termism and you know, short-term profit. I don't have shareholders on the public stock market saying to me, where's my returns, where's my dividends, et cetera. So we could take a much more longer-term view and do things differently and better. As we got further into it, I saw the opportunity to lead not only what we were doing in Kingdom and in the region, but actually be the leaders in a global transition towards a different way to go about developing. And that's how we've kind of evolved from, you know, creating new standards in sustainable development to actually setting the bar extraordinarily high for ourselves, partly to challenge ourselves for sure, but most important of all, leading by example, we hope that others will follow our lead. And I'm sure that as we go through this conversation, I'll be able to detail more of the specifics that we're doing that I hope others will soon follow and indeed eclipse what we ourselves are achieving and go beyond that. Because as we all take our collective responsibility for the challenges that we face, everybody does their part, we'll get somewhere. If everybody sits back waiting for somebody else to do something, nothing's going to happen.
There's so much to unpack there. Thank you for such an in-depth introduction here. Before we even dive deeper into how you are doing this, I think it's important to address the why. And you mentioned the kingdom's opening up and you want to do things right. But at the same time, I think it's important to give perspective. Most of my listeners are airline folks and aviation folks. And it's important to get the perspective. It is a generally accepted fact that aviation accounts for about 3.5% of global carbon emissions. But if you expand that to travel, it becomes 8%. If you expand that to hospitality, this is what I learned at the WTD summit, it goes to almost 11% because hotels and construction and all of this. And you are specifically in that hospitality realm. And this is an important conversation because nobody takes a flight and does not take an Uber to that destination and then does not stay at a hotel and maybe not use the jacuzzi or the sauna, which obviously all adds up to the energy bills. So there are so many things to think about here, and let's address them one by one. You live in Saudi Arabia. You are building Red Sea Global in the kingdom. And the one resource that there is a lot of in the Middle East, in the GCC, is sunlight. And I believe you are building a solar farm of your own to generate your own energy, I believe, offsetting almost 500,000 tons of carbon emissions annually. Tell us a little about that. Why solar? How are you doing this? Are you in the solar plant business alongside running a resort?
Well, okay. So I think really for even further context, and yes, I'll come back to the solar question in a second. I mean, to really highlight why and how we're doing, why we're doing things differently, and this, the context within which we're doing it is really to demonstrate to the world that there is a better way to do things. Technology exists today. What often is lacking is the will and the will to do it and the will to pay that fraction more for the cost of what you're providing, for the utilities in particular. So I'm in a country rich in fossil fuels. We have extensive power generation capabilities. And the early advice I was getting from our engineers was, because we wanted to be sustainable, et cetera. So they said, go solar, produce all your energy using solar by day, sell excess power into the grid during the day, and then at night draw that power back. And I said, that would make us somewhat of a fraud, right? Because what I send to the grid in the morning doesn't come back to me at night, right? The electrons I give them are not the electrons I get back. The electrons I get back are made from burning fossil fuels. So I took the decision very early on, and I told the engineers, we're going to go completely off grid. We're going to go 100% renewable energy. And at the beginning, we weren't sure of what the exact energy mix was, whether it would be all solar and wind. And we explored it many other types. But, you know, given where we are, the only one that actually was reliable and made sense was solar. And so we took the decision to go 100% solar. But the real key and the real game changer in terms of what we're doing was to say we're going to go 24 hours a day powered by solar energy. And we do that by installing large-scale utility-grade storage facilities, battery storage in this case, to produce the power by day, charge up the batteries, and at night we draw that power off. And we are now creating the largest tourism destination in the world that is powered 100% by renewable energy 24 hours a day. We are the largest microgrid in the world powered by renewable energy 24 hours a day. We're building the biggest battery storage system in the world today at 1.2 gigawatt hours or 1,200 megawatt hours. The technology exists. The will and the willingness to pay a fraction more is what's lacking. But we're trying to demonstrate it is possible that our customers, because you're going to ask, one of the whys we'll come back to in a second, but our customers, I promise you, our customers will pay an extra dollar per night of staying in one of our resorts if they know that their stay is going to be without a carbon footprint. And I think that's important. We're doing it for, first and foremost, it's the right thing to do, right? We've got to all take our actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And as you pointed out, just first phase Red Sea, 500,000 tons of carbon dioxide are not going to be emitted into the atmosphere on an annual basis. We're doing the same again at our sister project, one of my sister projects, Amala, which is also part of the Red Sea Global umbrella. Same again, totally off grid, microgrid. We'll save another 500,000. So between the two, 1 million tons of CO2 that's not emitted into the atmosphere. The other reason we're doing it is because it makes sense to do it. If you think of consumers, and consumer habits were changing well before COVID, there was always already a greater awareness around environment, sustainability, greenhouse gas emissions, rising temperatures, and the threats that poses to us as humans. COVID brought it into much sharper focus. I think we came to realize some of the impacts of the choices that we've made as human beings over time is a contributing factor to the pandemic. And so again, it's created more awareness that people now want to travel more sustainably. Yes, they understand they're going to fly somewhere. We're trying to reduce the overall carbon footprint that a guest coming to the Red Sea will take. You mentioned an Uber ride. When they come to our destination, there won't be Uber, but the journey from the airport to the destination, if you're going by car, is by electric vehicle. Okay? Difference though, this electric vehicle is powered by renewable energy. So if you drive an electric vehicle in London or in New York or anywhere else, the power that goes into that vehicle is not green. It's coming from a fossil fuel generating carbon gas emitting, installation. So all you're doing when you drive an electric vehicle in most other places is you're just shifting where the carbon is being generated. Okay, it's not being generated in the vehicle, it's being generated to generate the electricity, which then powers the vehicle. Here, you know that the power that we're generating is renewable and it's going into an electric vehicle. So the vehicle is genuinely zero emission. So I think that's a big part of what we're doing. So again, we're trying to lead by example and do things that we hope others will ultimately follow our lead.
This is pretty phenomenal. I think not many industry leaders are brave enough to go for the true zero proposition as opposed to net zero. I was recently watching Elon Musk on Tesla's next 10-year vision at Tesla Live. And if we may, let's geek out a little over batteries. You're building a battery storage facilities. Is this lithium ion with iron or is this with cobalt? What kind of battery storage mix are you looking at?
It is lithium ion. All lithium ion batteries will use cobalt and nickel and various recipes. I mean, the technology is fairly well established. Look, the battery technology doesn't define us. The battery technology is a means to an end. The next industrial revolution will come out of solving the energy storage problem. What form that takes, nobody's entirely certain of today. What is certain is lithium ion will in time become less, will not be the main source of energy storage because it's a finite resource. It has its own environmental issues associated with mining it, which is not great. And that has some human issues in terms of the way, the way it's done and exploitation of people, which is not great. So lots of research is being done in that space. But when somebody solves the storage problem, it's going to fundamentally transform all industry, not just power, but everything that requires power in one form or another, aviation in particular, right? The conundrum with aviation is you can fly an electric plane today. You can. You can't go very far, but you can fly one today. Why? Because the batteries are so heavy that you eat up all the payload to carry the batteries. People are now getting into hydrogen to solve that particular problem. So hydrogen is a very good energy store, has some challenges that have to be worked out, and that might be the solution. But that's, it's all around the energy storage. We can produce renewable energy, and we have been doing that for some time, wind, solar, and other forms of energy. But if they're not available 24/7, you have a problem. And solving the energy storage problem will unlock huge potential across the world. I mean, in every industry, in every walk of life.
Right. Very, very important and well said. And I love the vision here. Now, you mentioned you're building your own world's largest solar storage facility. Will you be selling energy to the grid? Will you have excess energy at all?
No, we're not connecting to the grid at all. And we did that very deliberately because the temptation once you connect is not that we can sell excess power, but that we might be tempted to draw power, and I wanted that to have that clean break because, again, we want to demonstrate that we are totally reliant on renewable energy. So, I have to give credit to the kingdom for, their own initiatives. They're, again, bearing in mind, oil is very abundant and available here in the kingdom. They've committed to transform their energy mix by 2030 to be 50% renewable energy. Now, that's a huge commitment. So in time, the national grid will become more balanced and more renewable energy will be generated as the primary source. I just don't want to wait that long to get it. And so we decided to do it ourselves. But I mean, they're being very bold and very ambitious in their own pursuit of changing the energy mix and less dependence on burning fossil fuels and relying more on renewable energy. And you also know that they're investing heavily in hydrogen. They want to become what Saudi Arabia is to oil today. They want to become the same for hydrogen globally. So they want to be the biggest producer of green hydrogen, not any hydrogen, but green hydrogen And that's again another credit to the the vision of the kingdom and the leadership to try to get ahead of the next energy source in the world.
This is indeed visionary, and I know I've been hearing a lot about this. It's great to be speaking with you because you're putting this into practice, and this is becoming a reality today, not in 2030, not in 2050. The other very interesting aspect, which I learned about when I was researching Red Sea Global, was blue carbon. It's a concept that we don't often talk about, especially in travel, but blue carbon is important. It's about mangroves and seagrasses and tidal marshes and what role they play in sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. How are you using blue carbon, or how is this part of your plans?
Well, look, I think it starts with recognizing the value of nature. I think, now the United Nations has introduced a different way that countries can, in terms of the way they describe and discuss the economic performance of a country, now natural capital is also one of the key constituents. And we recognize the value of our natural capital. What makes us so special is the uniqueness and the pristine nature that we call home. And by putting a value on it, and I often say to people, nature is our most valuable asset. We actually manage it. And so for us, the nature is what's going to make the place very unique. We make choices around protection of mangroves, corals, seagrass meadows, and so on. It was the essence of our starting point for the entire destination. Before we started designing the tourism destination, we brought scientists in. And the purpose behind the scientists being brought in early was to really understand our ecosystem. I understand what we have by way of nature. What is it that's unique about this place, and where's the most valuable places? So that when we choose to develop, we choose to develop not the most valuable ones, but the lesser valuable ones, so that we can make some trade-offs and protect and indeed enhance the areas that are set aside for development. So we recognized early on the importance that mangroves. You talk about mangroves being they are amazing sequesters of carbon. A fact that I only found out when I got much more involved in it, that they can be anywhere between 5 times and 10 times and arguably even more than that, more effective per area. So per hectare of mangrove, it's 5 to 10 times more effective at sequestering carbon than an equivalent hectare of rainforest. So destroy that at your peril, right? So we not only look to protect it and protect it, we also seek to enhance it. I'm committing ourselves to plant 50 million additional mangrove plants by 2030 because they are great sequesters of carbon. We've already touched on that. They protect us against sea level rise. They protect us against erosion. And they're fantastic habitats for all manner of marine life. And the combination of all of those things enhances biodiversity. So, and the richer your ocean environment, your environment is, the bigger the potential of your blue economy. People travel to experience nature, and the marine environment is particularly attractive to guests. There's obviously other aspects of the blue economy in terms of, food sources and so on. And all of those are big parts of that. We want to grow micro and macro algae and do that to sequester carbon. And maybe we'll even convert the microalgae and macroalgae into a biofuel and create our own sustainable aviation fuel. I'm not there yet, so don't quote me on that. But it's one of our areas of further research and study to see whether we could at some future date, right? We want to be net zero day one. But we also would love to be in a position where you want to come to the Red Sea, I'm going to sequester your carbon footprint. So that's where our ultimate ambition will be. I don't know when I'm going to get there, but that's a destination that we're certainly trying to get to. Because if I can make your travel to the Red Sea truly net zero, I think that will differentiate us from anywhere else. And then, as I said, if I do it and I'm starting to take consumers away from other destinations, people are going to be forced to do something similar. Otherwise, they're going to be at a disadvantage.
Absolutely. I think this is a very important point you mentioned. I don't believe there can be any destination in the world right now that can say your travel or your end-to-end trip was truly, it was true zero. It can be net zero. You can plant trees, you can plant mangroves, you can buy sustainable aviation fuel, but true zero is hard to achieve. Because you're starting from scratch, you can be. So let's talk about the two other aspects. If I am a foreigner, I want to travel from Canada to one of the Red Sea resorts, I will probably fly in, let's say on Saudia, and then I will land at the Red Sea Global Airport. Let's talk about both of these aspects. Let's talk about the airline first. I believe you are already collaborating with Saudia to operate net zero flights to the Red Sea Global Airport. Is that right?
Well, we're working with them. So the inaugural flight to the Red Sea will be fueled with sustainable aviation fuel. We're working very hard to make sustainable aviation fuel available in Kingdom, which today is not the case. So again, we're using our power and leverage to start to bring in sustainable aviation fuel, working with Aramco to try to get them to produce sustainable aviation fuel so that the airlines have the choice to fuel it. And I hope that consumers put pressure on the airlines, because the greater the adoption of sustainable aviation fuel, the lower the cost will become. More people will then use it. It's we're at this funny inflection point where it's available, but it's expensive because there isn't enough refining capacity in order to generate the volumes that would bring the cost down. And so people are doing it through wanting to become more sustainable. So the airlines in particular are increasingly committing to using sustainable aviation fuel and even business aviation, but it's not so widely available. And that's one of the challenges. And so, you know, we're using our positioning and our, you know, profile to try to bring that change here in Kingdom to make it available, you know, at Red Sea International. And so in so doing, we start to reduce the footprint, the carbon footprint of these flights coming into Kingdom, whether it's in domestic or international.
This is very exciting. I don't know of any destinations who are making sustainable aviation fuel to power the airlines and flights that come in there. You mentioned 100% SAF on the first Saudia flight. Is that 100% on the actual flight, or is that using book and claim?
No. They will fuel. They will fuel with sustainable aviation fuel. I didn't say 100% because most people will work up to anywhere. Again, it depends on the engines themselves and whether they've been tested and have gone through the civil aviation authorities in terms of sign off. You know, whether it's 30 or 50%, right? Nobody's running 100% sustainable aviation fuel yet, although many airframers are now testing to see whether they can. I think in time they will, but you know, the airline industry is and the aviation industry as a whole is highly regulated. And nobody wants to take, you know, undue risk, you know, prematurely. So I think it's an evolution. They started with 30%. Now more people are moving to 50%. And I think it's only a matter of time that you'll see 100% sustainable aviation fuel being used, you know, in commercial and business aircraft.
You're right. Thanks for qualifying that. And I appreciate you clarifying that. There's the airport part as well. The Red Sea Global Airport, which also you're involved in, I understand, will have a dedicated runway of seaplanes. It will support hydrogen-powered variants of planes, hydrogen-electric planes. And it will be a regenerative airport powered by 100% renewable energy. How are you doing this? Will you have a local hydrogen storage facility? Will you, now I know how you're making your own electricity. How is this coming together?
We're creating a center of excellence for hydrogen where we will... I mean, there's currently production facilities in Kingdom that we're going to tap into as we start to migrate into hydrogen. Our challenge on hydrogen is less about the hydrogen, because we can produce our own hydrogen. It's simple enough to bring in our own electrolyzers, because we'd like to localize it as much as possible to avoid having to transport hydrogen over large distances. The biggest challenge that we face from a hydrogen perspective is the end products, the vehicles, whether they're cars and trucks and vans, that industry hasn't fully evolved yet. Aviation is again another example where, you know, our you know, working with ZeroAvia, again, we're at the experimental phase. You know, there isn't a certified hydrogen fuel cell plant for a plane that has been certified by any of the civil aviation authorities. So it's very much an experimental phase, but highly promising, because the tech is understood. It's not, fuel cells have been around a long time. So it's not like we're reinventing the wheel, but it making it, applying it in an airline, in an aviation context, requires many levels of testings and certification because of, again, of the cell, you know, the importance of safety. So as we start to understand the, you know, can we get the products that will use the hydrogen, will determine at what point we start to generate our own hydrogen. And we will use renewable energy so that we are creating green hydrogen, and we will localize electrolyzers, you know, within our jurisdiction so that it's closely coupled with where we're going to consume. But we've already commissioned boats for guest transport that will be hydrogen fuel cell powered. So we are creating our own, you know, where it doesn't exist, we're trying to create it ourselves, because again, the industry isn't as developed. We're going to bring in some hydrogen buses. They do exist, so we're going to try those. Trucks, they're good. I mean, hydrogen is very good for larger, heavier duty applications. The electric vehicle, hydrogen vehicle debate is less about technology as much as it is about the ability, the infrastructure to distribute, right? Because with electricity, you can get charging points relatively easily at, you know, filling stations, etc. But for cars, the infrastructure to distribute hydrogen just doesn't exist, and that's a much longer journey. You know, I think there's one. I think California has done it in a very limited scale. So people that have hydrogen, and I think Toyota was one of the few manufacturers.
Yeah, it's Toyota's hydrogen fuel cell. You're right. That's the experiment they've done,
and it works, and it has a lot of attractions from the point of view. Refilling is, you know, the same as filling your tank with gasoline or with petrol. Problem is, as I said, they don't have the network of distribution of hydrogen like you have other forms of gases, or the ability to go and, you know, provide hydrogen at filling stations around the country. But that will come in time as people start to adopt it. So we need to get that critical mass of uses to be able to justify building electrolyzers. But we're certainly keen to do that. And I think aviation long term is likely to be the way they're going to get to, you know, net zero on in terms of aviation. Sustainable aviation fuel, it is a reduction in carbon. It isn't a complete elimination of it, whereas hydrogen will be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. It's very, very interesting what you mentioned. I actually had Val Miftikoff, ZeroAvia's CEO and founder, on the podcast previously, and he did speak about these distributed hydrogen facilities. So it's I'm glad to hear that there's someone implementing that vision as well. It's not just something, you know, sitting in the clouds. I'm curious. I'm sure most people do not know where Red Sea Global Resorts will be and how to get there. How does someone get there? Do you fly into Jeddah or Riyadh or Dubai and then fly over? Or do you take a bus ride, boat ride? How do you get there?
Again, depends on where you're starting from. But look, we're building a brand new airport, as you know, Red Sea International Airport. And it's a Code F airport. It'll take anything that's flying. It's 3.7 kilometers long. That's the principal runway. And we also have the seaplane runway, which you've already touched upon. So the way people will come, to, you know, they can fly through Jeddah and to Riyadh and through Dubai, because we will have, you know, flights from those destinations. But they, you know, there will be, in time as we mature and the destination grows in size, we'll have direct flights from international locations. The frequency of those flights will be a function of you know, load factors. You know, can we generate the load factors that would justify, you know, those routes? Now we have a slight dilemma in that we don't want to be a mass tourism destination. So I'm not my airport is designed for no more than 1 million passengers a year. And it was designed at 1 million passengers a year because that's the limit of the population that we want to bring to the destination. Because early on, we determined what our ecological ceiling was. And we don't believe that we could accommodate more than 1 million without starting to cause damage to the environment. So we're self-limiting the amount of development that we will undertake to limit the population, number of visitors that come to the destination, which from an aviation point of view is not what the aviation industry likes to see, because you don't have the footfall to drive, you know, more regular flights. But I think at the end of the day, they'll fly. I think some markets will generate flights that are going to be direct. They may not be daily. They may be, you know, a couple of times a week, but we will have direct flights from certainly Western Europe and maybe parts of Asia. And then use, you know, hub and spoke arrangements with Riyadh. I mean, you know, the kingdom is expanding their airport footprint. I mean, Riyadh's airport is going to grow substantially. Jeddah has already grown and may grow some more. So they are going to become, and they're creating a new airline, which will create even more connectivity for us, because they'll fly to more destinations around the world. So people will be able to fly into Riyadh, for example, and then from Riyadh to the Red Sea, it's an hour and a half. So, and again, if we can create the journey in a very comfortable way with, you know, brand new modern aircraft and have good facilities at either end, I think we can, I think people won't mind that one connection.
Right. You touched upon something very interesting. It is almost counterintuitive to hear a travel executive say, I want to curb travel. And you mentioned something, the ecological ceiling. So let's touch upon that a bit. It's about the 1% is what I've heard you say, is where, you know, you want less than 1% of the total site to be actually developed so that the rest of it is preserved. Tell us a bit more about this, and how do you ensure that this is actually the case?
Okay, well, so I mentioned before that we brought the scientists in early to evaluate our destination. So, and what we did, and look, we have the 1% is that we have a site that's 28,000 square kilometers. Okay. So to put that into a context, I'm not sure which state or province, but it's the size of Belgium. Okay. So I have a country sized piece of land. We're never going to develop all of it, right? It was never the intention. We have an archipelago that's 2,500 square kilometers of marine environment with 90 islands in it. And we undertook this extensive marine spatial planning simulation. And let me describe that to you. And this was the largest ever undertaken in the world. We literally took the entire marine environment and divided it up into 30,000 squares and assigned conservation values to each and every square. And we then iterated development, locations, size, quantum. Through that process, what we were trying to do was determine how many people could we accommodate that would not just sustain and maintain the status quo, because we thought that was too lame. And we'll get on to why we've moved away from sustainability. Remind me to talk to you about that. But we wanted to actually enhance the destination. So we set our goal to increase the net conservation value of our destination by 30% over the next two decades. And that's compared with leaving the site untouched. So we're going to develop, but actually improve and increase the net conservation value. Through that process, we established what the maximum carrying capacity of the destination would be. And that's where we came up with 1 million. That 1 million isn't hard, because one of the things that we will do as we develop, you know, is we're creating a smart destination. We're going to deploy, you know, Internet of Things sensors throughout our environment with real-time monitoring, with real-time using artificial intelligence and machine learning, so that we can actually monitor all of that, everything that's happening in the environment, so that we can get early indications of anything that's not going to plan. So, you know, we may end up saying, look, it's not 1 million, it's 900,000. And that's, you know, we'll have that ability to do that. The question is, how do we demonstrate it? And I think that's a valid point, because it's easy for us to make bold statements. How do you prove it? How do I not get accused of greenwashing and the like? And the way we're doing that is to be transparent. We've undertaken the most extensive baseline survey ever undertaken by a private developer. And we did that work over the course of a year. Rather than just keep that to ourselves, we've published it. So you have access to it. I think it's on our website, but it's available for you to see. We also publish our own sustainability report. We've now published the second version. We're about to publish, I think we published our second version. In it, we will monitor and report against our performance. So we will demonstrate to everybody, are we achieving the, you know, we set our goals very high, and I make no apology of that. I hope we achieve and exceed them, but we may fail in some areas. But we're going to do that transparently, so people will know how we're tracking towards that 30% net conservation benefit. Our goal is to do better, but we will do it on an open book basis, so people can see and judge us for what we are. If we're not achieving it, they'll know we're not achieving it, but they'll know for sure that we're trying our utmost to make it happen. And by doing it on an open, transparent basis, we will increase the confidence in you know, what we're doing, and the belief in what we're doing, which I think is important, because I said this, it's become far too far too fashionable to talk about sustainability. Everybody's talking about it because they're forced to do it, right? I mean, you've got corporates now very much focused on ESG because, not because they necessarily believe it, I'm being a little bit cynical, but shareholder pressure, consumer pressure, so they're not having to do it. We're trying to do it because as I said before, we did it from the very beginning. We weren't forced to do it, but we did it because we believe genuinely that it's the right thing to do. And as I said before, we're facing, you know, an environmental and ecological crisis. But we want to do it in a transparent way. And more people do it transparently, more people will start to believe that people, corporates in particular, and governments are taking real steps and real actions. Because we're beyond the point of talking. Everybody talks. I mean, COP is, you know, COP 26, 27, next year 28, this year 28. Everybody talks about what are we going to do, but very few people are actually doing. We want to be in that camp of doing, and we are doing. That's something we're particularly proud of. Because, again, if more people see others doing, then they'd be compelled to do themselves. And if we can build some momentum around that, then we stand some chance of, you know, avoiding a disaster through you know, a lack of action to address, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and more.
I'm so glad that you're leading with action and leading from the front. And, you know, action matters way more than words here. When can guests come visit? I believe in Amala, there are multiple resorts. You've had recent announcements with top resorts from around the world opening soon. When can guests actually come in? What will this guest experience be like?
Let me tell you a bit about the scale of what we're building in the first phase. So, and Red Sea Global is the main company that now has multiple projects. Red Sea, the project is one project. Amala is another project. The first phase of Red Sea and Amala together will deliver 24 hotels, around 4,000 hotel rooms, plus residential, plus all of the enabling infrastructure that we've been talking about in terms of renewable energy and so on, the airports, roads, bridges, you name it, everything that makes this place work. Red Sea is slightly ahead of Amala. It started a little bit earlier. We will open our first resort in the next couple of months. So we'll be opening our Six Senses resort in a couple of months' time. And then we will open a month or so after that, we'll open St. Regis. And a month or so after that, we'll open up Ritz-Carlton Reserve. So we will open three resorts this year. And so guests can come and experience some of our island destinations, as well as one of our inland destinations, which is the Six Senses Resort, which is in the sand dunes, but a very unique location with you know, amazing terrain and topography around it. Next year, towards the end of next year, we will open up the balance of the 21 resorts. So another 21 resorts to take us to 24 resorts. And you've seen the announcements of all of the major brands, but we have, you know, we have Four Seasons, we have Rosewood, we have Intercontinental, we have Jumeirah, Raffles, Fairmont, Grand Hyatt, Faena, Edition, SLS, Miraval. I've already mentioned Six Senses, Ritz-Carlton Reserve, by the way, the fifth Ritz-Carlton Reserve in the world. We've just announced Clinique La Prairie up at Amala. We've just announced Jayasam at Amala. And there's many more that we're currently in final stages of contracting with. So huge numbers of the best global brands want to be here. That tells you something about, you know, the opportunities for the tourism space and the leisure travel industry here in Kingdom. It's backed by the biggest brands in the world. They believe in what we're doing and they're coming in large numbers.
This is super exciting. I can't wait to experience this myself. Initially, when we started speaking, I thought this would remind me of my last visit to Al Ula and, you know, how it was a very nice, different resort. As we speak more, this is making me think this is going to be more like my trip to Tahiti and the super exclusive resorts in Bora Bora, just true zero and off the grid, as opposed to relying on fossil fuels. This is indeed very, very exciting. And I love that, once again, you're leading with action and not words. The final part of this interview, John, is the rapid fire round, in which we learn a little bit about yourself. And you get to share, you know, we get a bit personal. And it's just simple questions. We'll start very, very...
Don't get too personal.
We'll start very, very simple. For example, what's your favorite movie?
Favorite movie? I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, we'll come back to that.
I'll tell you, The Godfather.
The Godfather, right? Good pick. Good pick.
I was born in Canada, but I'm Italian, so Godfather for sure.
Fantastic. Good choice. No, you cannot go wrong with that. What about your favorite book?
Steve Jobs, his biography.
The Walter Isaacson version?
Yes, because great book. I mean, more about the man and, I thought this guy was, it really fundamentally changed our lives. And it was a fascinating read, really understanding his own personal demons and struggles, but genius in the way he, was able to come up with, ideas that, I said, fundamentally changed our lives. Look, we're walking around with these things. You don't have this. How would we get by our days, without these devices? And he was the creator of these designs. But what really struck me about him, and I learned that through that book, was his attention to detail, which I found fascinating. Really wanting to understand what's inside the case, not what the customer sees, but he was obsessed with, how perfect the internals of the device is, even though nobody would ever see it. But that's the degree to which he was focused on the details. And I think there's lots of lessons there for, executives around the world to follow.
Absolutely. If you like the Walter Isaacson version of Steve Jobs' biography, then you might also enjoy Elon Musk by Ashley Vance.
Okay.
Which, again, is all about attention to detail. What is your favorite city?
London, England.
Okay.
Place I've called home. There are a number of world cities that I would, it's a tough one because I love Paris, I love London, I love New York. But if I have to choose one, London has got the right mix of everything. It's got history, it's got culture, it's got the arts. It's a very walkable city, which I think is also, very important. So I think that's top of my list.
Very, very high walk score, and it's incredibly clean. I grew up in Singapore, so I was used to clean standards before I moved to Canada. But then, yes, London, for its population density, is incredibly clean and walkable. You're right. How are you personally taking steps to reduce your own carbon footprint? What do you do in your daily life?
I think first thing I did when I came into this business, I stopped using single-use plastics. We got rid of all the single-use plastics. What I'm doing in my daily life is trying to change people's behavior generally, leading by example. It's hard to reduce your own carbon footprint if you think about it, because you do fly and it's not the most sustainable thing to do. But it's taking those small steps and those small decisions. Walking, for example, walk more instead of getting in a car, helps reduce your carbon footprint. Eating less beef, it's kind of surprising when you think about how much carbon, greenhouse gases are emitted through that process. So by changing your diet slightly, that every little bit helps. Again, my big mantra is we all have responsibility for our environment. You can't just look at governments, you can't just look at corporates. We as individuals, if we all take our little steps, right? Don't use plastic bags. Don't buy the single-use plastic bottles of water, because if you buy them, you don't encourage change in the manufacturers. The manufacturers will do it because it's more economical. But if people say, no, I'll pay that extra, 50 cents, but I'll have a glass bottle or I'll have a reusable bottle, people will start to change their behaviors. And so, it's that collective responsibility we all have to take. And if we start to do that, when you add it all together with the population of the world, now you're going to make some inroads towards reducing, the increase in temperatures through reduction of carbon, carbon emissions.
That's good. Little things that we can do every single day. What is something you want to learn, John?
Something I want to learn?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. I'm going in for my next type rating, so that's something I want to learn.
Are you learning to fly? Do you already fly?
I do already fly. I fly my own plane, so yeah. What would I like to learn? I never even thought about that. Let me put it this way. I learn every day. Every day is learning about, what's happening in the world. It's learning about people. It's learning about new societies. I mean, I think the journey I'm on here is remarkable in that respect, because I'm learning about a whole new culture. The Saudi people are amazing, which, again, I've come to learn and know and love. But I'm past the point of academics, though. I have a scientific mind and a scientific background, so you know that side.
Perhaps getting type rated on a zero avia hydrogen hybrid aircraft might be an interesting.
Well, for sure, I'm going to get my seaplane rating. That's for sure. And then as soon as we can get the hydrogen fuel cell going, I'll definitely do that too.
Fantastic. Who do you look up to?
Who do I look up to? Look, I guess over time you look up to a number of different people. You look up to your father, you know, as you know, your first role model. I know this is going to sound like I'm a psychophant. I think MBS, not because he's the crown prince, but the way he does his thing, his attention to detail is amazing. But he works extraordinarily hard. You know, for somebody who doesn't have to, he could easily sit back and just rest on laurels, be happy in the wealth that they've created. But he is working tirelessly to deliver Vision 2030. And I admire his work ethic when you can imagine he wouldn't need to do that. He wouldn't need to work as hard as he does. And I believe he works pretty much to, I don't know exactly how many hours a day, but you know, we meet sometimes in the middle of the night because he's got meeting after meeting after meeting. I've been lucky to meet some great leaders. I met Margaret Thatcher, you know, while she was still alive, and I was, you know, was profoundly affected by her. She was such a great, you know, she changed the United Kingdom, you know, for the better. Highly controversial, but you know, amazing to have met her. And again, somebody that I would have looked up to and would do so today if she was still alive.
Fantastic. Very inspiring indeed. And final question, what is the best advice you've received?
Okay, so the best advice I've received is sort of more a conclusion or opinion I've formed myself. And that is, and I don't know whether I got it from somebody, but I've reached the conclusion that we need to get out of our comfort zone, you know, to really grow personally, professionally. It's far too easy to become complacent. You know, you get comfortable in a role or an environment, and you know that could set your life, and it's fine. You can be happy in that, but stepping outside your comfort zone really allows you to grow, expand your horizons, expand your opportunities. I mean, that would be, if I'm giving advice, and I do give that advice, especially to our elite graduates who join us on, you know, we have an intake every year of fresh young Saudi graduates, and I often tell them, you know, be bold, get out of your comfort zone, because you grow as you do things that, you know, you didn't think you could do. But if you're determined and if you've got initiative, there's very little that will hold you back. And I use myself as an example. I started life as an engineer, and through steps over time, every time you get to a crossroad and there's, you know, and I, as you reflect back on your life, as you get a little bit older, you look at, you know, oh my God, how different would my life have been had I stayed within my comfort zone and not stepped out? And by doing so, I was able to do things that I would never have imagined. And I've been very fortunate and blessed in my career. And that's the sort of wisdom I'd like to impart on others. As I said, I don't know exactly where I picked that up along my journey, but somewhere along the line, I became aware of that maybe it was the crossroads. You know, you get to a crossroad, and do I stay here? I'm comfortable. Life is good. Or do I just step out there? I'm sure I can do it. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm sure I can. But taking that opportunity is what propelled me personally, and professionally in particular. And I think that's the best advice I've ever received, either directly or through my own creation.
Brilliant words to live by, John. It's something I live by myself, moving to Whistler. No airport.
learning to ski. Eh?
Learning to ski in my 30s. You know, it's been a fantastic journey, and truly enjoyed this conversation. I love, once again, what you are trying to do at Red Sea Global and Amala Resorts. I can't wait to experience it myself. But I think it serves, this is like a petri dish. It serves as a model for the rest of the world to see what can be done, not just what can be talked about. And because you have a clean slate, I think you have a bit of an advantage where you can create things from scratch, and it's great to see this. It's very inspiring.
No, thank you. Look, and we love to talk about what we're doing because we get our message across, and the more people come to learn of what we're doing, the more I hope people will start to follow what we're doing. I think that's the key, you know, message from us. For us as a place, it's the place is one thing, but the significance and the importance of the platform and the stage upon which we're performing, I think, is really the most inspiring part of what we do, because we're not only hoping to solve some challenges here, but if we can start to get others to do it as well, I think we take our steps towards changing the course of humanity that currently facing some severe headwinds in our journey. So thank you.
Indeed, thank you very much, John. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. Awareness is the key to a green future, so please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing us with your network or leaving a review. For more information on how aircraft emissions data can help you reach your sustainability goals, visit Cirium from the link in the show notes. You can start a conversation with us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, simplifying.com, and join the movement.